Irene. What is she doing? What is she doing? What is she doing? She is throwing away the rule book, she thinks, and it feels okay. For the first 57 years of her life, Irene stayed on script. She was a dutiful daughter, a good student in both high school and college. She got married, had children, took a job that was suited to her. She had been a good mother, or good enough. The boys were fine. She had been a good wife, hadn't she? It's only at night, after Irene has taken one of the pills that Anna prescribed, that she allows herself to indulge in self-doubt. Where did she go wrong? She feels like she must have done Russ a huge, terrible injustice somewhere along the way for him to engage in a deception so wide and deep. But she comes up with nothing. She wasn't sure what to expect when she arrived here. The villa and the island are as foreign as Neptune. What she finds surprising are the small flashes of her own influence that she stumbles across. All of the beds, she's noted, have six pillows, along with one oversized decorative pillow against the headboard, one small square decorative pillow in front, and a cylindrical bolster. This is exactly how Irene dresses the beds at home. She had no idea Russ had ever noticed. Also, the wine Russ keeps on hand, cases of it on the ground floor, are her two favorites, cake bread and simi. It's almost as if Russ expected her to show up for a drink one day. She wouldn't say these details made her feel at home, although they do provide a connection. This was her husband's house. Her husband's house. And now her husband is dead. These pieces of news that were initially so difficult to conceive, she's now finally processing. This is Russ's house. Russ is dead. She's also becoming acclimatized to life here. The temperature, the surroundings, the particulars of the villa. Kind of the way one gets used to the thin air at altitude after a few days. Irene remembers when she and Russ used to visit Cash in Breckenridge. She would suffer from shortness of breath, headaches, strange dreams, and then these symptoms would gradually fade away. She supposes this goes to show that one can get used to anything. Seeking out Captain Sam Powers, Huck, had been a bold move, Irene knows. She had desperately wanted to hold someone accountable. She can't confront Rosie, but why not Rosie's parents? Huck had been nothing like what Irene expected. First of all, he was white. He was Rosie's stepfather, married to Rosie's deceased mother. Secondly, he was kind. Gruff, yes, at first, and unenthusiastic about talking to her. Can she blame him? But he seemed to understand that they were in the same boat, so to speak. Irene had stunned herself by asking to go fishing, and Huck had further stunned her, and likely himself, by agreeing. He could easily have told her to go away and leave him alone. He owed her nothing. He had lost a daughter, and Irene could see that his pain equaled her own. He deserved a day out on his boat by himself. That they had enjoyed such a cathartic and successful outing, and that this dinner had evolved from that says... what? That misery loves company, she supposes. That they are not enemies, but rather casualties of the same sordid circumstances. Huck likely has as many questions for her as she does for him, but of course, she has no answers. She had such an easy time finding Huck that, first thing on Monday morning, when she is feeling vestiges of her usual back-to-work, beginning-of-the-week attitude, she tries to track down Todd Croft. Cash had checked with Paulette, who had no contact information for Todd Croft herself. Paulette dealt only with Marilyn Monroe and with Stephen Thompson, an associate, she said, from the British Virgin Islands, who was the third person who had died in the helicopter crash. Irene tries Marilyn Monroe's number again, but it's still disconnected. She tries the Ascension webpage, but just as Baker had claimed, it won't load. Someone took it down. Russ's cell phone isn't in the house, though Irene has called it several times each day. Every time the phone starts ringing, her heart tenses in anticipation. Will today be the day that Russ answers? Is he alive somewhere? No. After two rings, it clicks over to animated voicemail. Irene doesn't even have the luxury of hearing Russ's recorded voice. If she did, she would, likely, scream at him each time. Irene tries to access Russ's cell phone records. She knows his phone number, of course, but the phone bill was paid by Ascension and she has no idea which carrier he uses. She tries contacting AT&T, Verizon, and T-Mobile, but gets nowhere. She wonders if he uses a carrier out of the British Virgin Islands, but here she grows frustrated. Even if she figures out the carrier, she doubts they'll give her access to his call log without a court order. Russ said that he'd been acquainted with Todd Croft at Northwestern, so Irene checks the Northwestern alumni directory. There's no Todd Croft. She could, potentially, ask one of Russ's other friends from Northwestern, Leo Pelosi or Niles Adrian, but she hasn't seen either of them since their wedding 35 years earlier. She has their mailing addresses. They exchange Christmas cards every year, but not phone numbers or email addresses. Russ doesn't go to reunions. The last time he went to Northwestern was 8 years earlier for Baker's graduation. A garden variety Google of the name Todd Croft, paired with the name Ascension and then separately with Miami, yields nothing fruitful. Irene grows frustrated. In this day and age, everyone has a digital profile. Someone just told her that, but who? Mavis Key. Mavis Key had explained to Irene and to Irene's boss, Joseph Feeney, that with some new software, they could learn a lot more about their subscribers' purchasing habits. Irene is just desperate enough to do the unthinkable. She calls Mavis Key. "Hey, Irene," Mavis says. She sounds both surprised and concerned. "I heard you had a family emergency. Is everything okay?" "Everything is the opposite of okay," Irene wants to say. "My husband is dead, and he had a secret life." She should have thought this conversation through before she dialed. She needs to convey that the family emergency is real, without disclosing even a hint about what has happened. "Things are difficult right now," Irene says. "Very difficult. But I can't get into it. I called you because I need some help finding someone." "Finding someone," Mavis says. "I'm at the Java House getting a chai." Before Irene can think that, of course Mavis Key is downtown on the pedestrian mall where all the hip university students hang out, ordering a chai, whatever that is. Mavis adds, "Let me sit down with my laptop. I love detective work." Irene feels herself relax. Mavis sounds self-assured. She's 31 years old, essentially the same age as Irene's children, but she exudes both confidence and competence. Irene cherishes competence in everyone, even Mavis Key. "The man's name is Todd Croft," Irene says. "He's in his mid to late 50s. He's a banker, a businessman in Florida, I think, Miami. His business is called Ascension. He went to Northwestern." Mavis double-checks the spelling of Croft and of Ascension. Then Irene can hear her fingertips flying across a keyboard. "LinkedIn," Mavis murmurs. "Tumblr, Instagram, Snapchat, Twitter, Facebook." This is a world Irene has actively resisted. People encouraged her to start a Facebook page about her home renovation, but Irene had been so immersed in the work itself that there had been no time left over to document it. "I'm not finding him," Mavis says. "Do you know where he worked before Ascension? Do you know if he has kids or where they went to school? Do you know where in Miami he lives? Do you know if he owns property?" "I don't," Irene admits. She chastises herself for being so impetuous. It isn't like her. Now Mavis will go back to the office and tell everyone that Irene is looking for a 50-something banker from Miami. And what will people think? Well, whatever they think, it won't be as awful as the truth. Never mind, Irene says. I just called on a whim. I need to get a hold of this gentleman because he has some information that will assist with my family issues. But thanks anyway, Mavis. Oh, Mavis says. No problem. When do you think you'll be back? The office isn't the same without you. We're kind of like a bunch of crazed teenagers when Mom is away. Irene imagines Beyoncé and Drake playing at full blast over the office sound system, microwave popcorn ground into the rug of the common room, long, expensed lunch breaks at Formosa, and the entire staff cutting out early for craft cocktails in the name of team building. Everyone at the magazine probably views Irene as a schoolmarm, smacking her yardstick into her palm. Irene offers a paltry laugh. I'll be back next week to restore order, she says. Thanks, Mavis. She can't hang up fast enough. The boys leave for dinner. Irene asks them to stay out until 11, a request that is met with blank stares. Neither of them have asked what she's planning. They're afraid of her, she realizes. They're afraid that at any minute she's going to crack open like Pandora's box, and all the bad stuff is going to come flying out. That's fine. They can think what they want, as long as they give her privacy tonight. She puts two bottles of wine on ice and pulls things out of the fridge that she can serve with grilled mahi. Camembert with crackers to start, pasta salad and the makings of a green salad as sides. There's a fruit salad she can serve for dessert with packaged cookies. Food is the least of her worries. She pours herself a glass of wine, the first since she left the Pullman Bar and Diner 6 days ago. Thinking about the Pullman and prairie lights leads Irene to thoughts of Millie. Cash called Millie on Saturday evening, and Millie had been unable to come to the phone. What must Millie think? That they've abandoned her? Irene grabs her cell phone and calls Millie while she sets the table for two. She debates setting out candles. They're more flattering than the outdoor lighting, but will Irene be sending the wrong message? The boys were kind enough not to ask why she was wearing a sundress and earrings. Possibly they hadn't noticed. Irene wants to look nice and normal, though not like she's trying too hard. She has left her hair hanging down her back, still damp from the shower. No makeup. It's best if Huck sees her how she really is. As she decides no to candles, then yes to candles, why deny herself the pleasure of candlelight? Dot, the head nurse on the medical floor, answers. Dot, this is Irene Steele. I know I've been lax about calling this week. Oh, Irene, Dot says. Cash called and let us know that you were all taking a vacation. Are you back? No, Irene says. Not yet. She stands at the deck railing and looks out at the sky, striped pink, as the sun sets out of sight to the left. The water has taken on a purplish hue, and pinpricks of light start to appear on the neighboring islands. This view is probably what someone like Dot thinks of when she thinks of vacation. And yet, I haven't called you because I don't want to rain on your parade, Dot says. But Millie is failing, Irene. It's nothing dramatic, just a steady decline I've noticed since the first of the year. She's not going to die tomorrow. I don't want you running home. But I figured you ought to know. Irene is silent. Millie has been failing since the first of the year, the day that Russ died, her only child. It's almost as if she sensed it. Is she awake now? Irene asks. Can I speak with her? She's been asleep for hours, Dot says. But I'll tell her you called. Around lunchtime is best if you want to try again tomorrow. Try again tomorrow, Irene thinks, so she can lie to Millie and tell her everything is fine. Cash surprised her with a vacation. The Caribbean is beautiful. Okay, Irene says, I'll do that. Huck arrives a few minutes after 7. From her second floor guest room window, Irene watches his truck snake up the driveway. She checks her hair, then hurries down the stairs to meet him at the door. This is not a date, she tells herself, though her nerves are bright and jangly with anticipation. She will attempt to make Huck her ally. She needs one here on this island. Irene opens the door. Huck has cleaned up a bit himself. His red-gray hair is combed, his yellow shirt pressed. He's holding a bag of fish fillets, more than they could possibly eat, in one hand, and a bottle of... He immediately hands the bottle over to Irene. Flor de Caña rum, 18 years old.
Thought we might need that, he says.
Irene accepts the bottle gratefully. It solves the problem of how to greet him, air kiss or handshake. Now, neither is necessary. Come on in, she says. Did you have any problem finding it?
You know, I've lived here 20 years, Huck says, and I never knew this road existed. Does it have a name?
Lover's Lane, Irene says.
Seriously?
That's what the deed says. This is a development, new as of this afternoon. Paulette Vickers managed to produce the deed. The house, known as Number 1 Lover's Lane, is owned solely by Russell Steele. This news had come as a solid punch to the gut. Irene had secretly believed that they would discover the property was owned by Todd Croft or Ascension Investments. If that had been the case, Irene could have believed Russ was a pawn, manipulated by his powerful boss. More than once after Russ accepted the job from Todd, Irene realized that he'd made a deal with the devil. But had Irene ever encouraged him to quit? Never. The money had been too seductive. They had needed it so badly at first. Then came the house on Church Street. Once Irene became accustomed to having money, it was impossible to imagine life otherwise. According to Irene's lawyer in Iowa City, Ed Sorley, Russ's will leaves everything to her in the entirety should she survive him. Irene asked Ed when Russ had signed that will. She worried that another will would materialize, leaving everything to Rosie Small. But Ed said that Russ had come in to sign a new will in September, one that included a new life insurance policy he'd taken out, to the tune of $3 million. September, Irene said. This was news to her. She remembered them both signing new wills back when they bought the Church Street property.
Yes, Ed says. Why do you ask? Is everything all right?
Never better, Irene said. Then she hung up.
Well, Huck says now, stepping into the foyer, this is quite a place.
Quite a place. Huck follows Irene through the entry hall into the kitchen. Irene doesn't feel like giving him a tour, although there is something she wants to show him upstairs after dinner. Let me get you something to drink, Irene says. I have wine chilled or... She looks at the rum. She's not sure what to do with it. No one has ever brought her a bottle of rum before. Can I make you a cocktail? We have Coke, I think. Huck opens a cabinet and pulls out 2 highball glasses. He pours some rum in each.
Let's do a shot, Huck says. Then we can be civilized folks and switch to wine.
Throwing away the rule book. Deal, Irene says. She lifts her glass, raises it to Huck, and throws the rum back. It burns, but not as much as she expected. It has a certain smoothness, like fiery caramel. Well, she says.
Good stuff, Huck pronounces. Now, if you can find me olive oil, salt, pepper, and a lemon, I'll marinate our catch. 30 minutes later, Irene is slightly more relaxed, thanks to the rum, a glass of the cake bread, and a man who is as confident a cook as he is a fisherman. Irene sits at the outdoor table as Huck grills, and when he brings the platter of fish to the table, she finds herself hungry for the first time since the call came. Huck takes the seat next to Irene, then pauses a moment, looking at the food. He seems like he's about to speak, make a toast, maybe, or say grace. Do they have anything to be grateful for? Well, they're still here. To us, she says, the survivors. Huck nods. Let's eat. Airs. The restaurant clears out by 10:15 as usual, though there are still a couple of people at the bar, including Baker's brother, Cash. Or maybe Ayers should be thinking of Baker as Cash's brother. She likes them both. Baker is hotter, but Ayers feels more comfortable around Cash. She wipes down the tables, clears all the dishes, unties her apron, and throws it in the hamper. Chef hired someone to replace Rosie, an older gentleman named Dominic, which Ayers supposes is for the best. Skip pours Ayers a glass of the Schramsberg to drink as he counts out her tips. Ayers, Cash calls across the bar. Come sit. He raises his beer aloft, and Ayers drifts over but does not commit to sitting down. Baker had said he'd be back at 10, and Ayers plans on taking him to De Colpot. She has been dreaming about the oxtail stew all night. Rosie had loved the oxtail stew at De Colpot and the curried goat. So how was your dinner? Ayers asks Cash.
Was good, Cash says.
He's slurring his words. From the looks of things, he's even drunker than he was on Treasure Island. Ayers notices the Jeep keys next to his placemat.
Water here, please.
Ayers says to Skip with a look. She wonders if her date to De Colpot is in jeopardy. Baker will have to drive Cash home. He can't drive himself. Ayers feels a hand on her back and turns, expecting to see Baker, but, whoa, surprise. It's Mick. He's wearing a sky blue beach bar t-shirt, and his hair is damp behind the ears. He's working, obviously, but what Ayers doesn't understand is why, if he's going to sneak off for a drink, doesn't he go somewhere else? Why not Joe's Rum Hut or the Banana Deck? Why does he have to come here?
Hey, he says.
He waves to Skip, and a cold island summer IPA lands in front of him. What? She says.
I came to see how you're holding up, Mick says. Want to get a drink? I just got off. And actually, I'm starving. Want to grab Chinese at 4:20?
Chinese at 4:20, their old ritual. 4:20 to Center is a dive bar next to Slim's parking lot, where everyone in the service industry goes after his or her shift. It's owned by two guys from Boston. 4:20 to Center is some reference to Fenway Park. They do whip up remarkably good Chinese food late night. Time was, not so long ago, that Mick and Ayers were the king and queen of 4:20 to Center. But that time has passed. Ayers hasn't been to 4:20 once this season. She avoided it because she assumed Mick went there with her successor. Speaking of which, where's Bridget? Ayers asks. Mick shrugs. Trouble in paradise? She says.
It was never paradise.
Ayers thinks about this for a moment. Ayers would have called what she and Mick had paradise. Yes, she would have. They were in love, in St. John. They had good jobs and the same days off, and they knew everyone. When they went out, it was hard to pay for a drink. They both loved the beach, the sun, sex, hiking, drinking tequila, and Mick's dog, Gordon. What could Ayers assume when Mick left but that Bridget, young, alluring Bridget, offered something even more sublime?
to discover that this maybe wasn't true, that life with Bridget had somehow not lived up to expectations is, of course, enormously satisfying. But only for a fleeting moment. Mick is here, she realizes, not to see how Ayers is holding up. No, it's not about Ayers' emotional state, but rather about Mick's. He wants her company or he wants sex, probably the latter. But Ayers doesn't have time for it. Oh, well, she says, and she turns back to Cash, who has consumed his water and seems reinvigorated, like the herbs in Ayers' garden after a rain. You feeling better? Yes, Cash says. Do you know what time it is? Nearly 10, she says. She can feel Mick at her back, watching her, and probably sizing up Cash. When they were a couple, Mick had been fiendishly jealous of every single one of Ayers' male customers, single or married, in the restaurant or on the boat, and yet in the end, it was he who had put his head up someone else's skirt. Are you calling it a night? I wish, Cash says. I can't go home for another hour. My mother has a guest for dinner and she wants privacy. Your mother, Ayers says, did she meet someone here? Or do you know people? Met someone, Cash says, apparently. So your parents are divorced? Ayers asks. Divorced? Cash says. He takes what seems like a long time to consider the question. No, no. Another pause, during which Ayers hears Mick and Skip talking about a supposed surfable swell in Reef Bay. It was Ayers' least favorite thing about Mick. He professed to be a surfer, and he used all the lingo. But the one time Ayers had watched him surf, he hadn't even been able to stand up on the board. And when he'd come back to shore, he'd blamed his failure on the waves. My father is dead. Because she was distracted, it takes Ayers a moment to process this statement. Dead? She says. I'm sorry. Recently? Cash nods. Really recently. That's kind of why we're down here. Down here. Family reunion, maybe the first vacation since the father died, which is why the mother came along. You're still here, a voice says. Ayers turns around to see Baker standing behind her, and also, of course, behind Mick. Baker is as big, tall, and broad as a tree. He's staring down his brother. Mom said stay out until 11, Cash says. Where else was I supposed to go? Yeah, I don't know, Baker says, but Ayers and I are going out, and you're not invited. His tone is strong, nearly bullying, and Ayers feels bad for Cash. She understands now that both Cash and Baker are interested in her, and she wished they'd sorted this out at home to save her from being stuck in the middle, although a small part of her is gloating because what better situation for Mick to witness than two men fighting over her? Where are you guys going? Cash asks. None of your business, Baker says, so harshly that Ayers winces. But then he softens and says, Listen, just give us an hour, okay, man? I'll be back to pick you up at 11, I promise. But where are you going? Cash asks. De Coal Pot, Ayers says. It's Caribbean food. You're welcome to... Cash holds up a hand. You guys go. I ate. De Coal Pot? Mick says. I could go for some oxtail stew myself. Not happening, Ayers thinks. This is not happening. She is smacked by a wave of devastating sorrow. The person she needs by her side right now isn't Mick or Baker or Cash. It's Rosie. Can you see this? Ayers asks Rosie in her mind. Please tell me you are somewhere you can see this. Baker swings around. Who are you? He asks Mick. Mick wisely holds up his hands. No one, he says. I'm no one. Baker and Ayers walk down the street toward the coal pot, although Ayers finds she no longer has any appetite. She needs air. She needs space.
I'm not hungry anymore, she says. Let's go down to the beach.
You lead, Baker says. I'll follow.
Ayers takes him down past the beach bar to the far edge of Frank Bay where it's dark and quiet. Out on the water, she sees the ferry making its way toward St. Thomas. On the far horizon, she spies a cruise ship, all lit up like a floating city. Ayers sits in the cool sand, and Baker eases down next to her.
Your brother is pretty drunk, Ayers says.
I didn't realize you knew him so well, Baker says. That came as a surprise.
He didn't tell you we bumped into each other on the Reef Bay Trail? Ayers says. He saved my life. Or at least it felt like it at the time. So as a thank you, I invited him to come on Treasure Island yesterday. I didn't think he'd show up, but he did.
Of course he did, Baker says. When a gorgeous woman invites you somewhere, you go.
Ayers smiles. She's flattered by the compliment. But then she chastises herself. She can't let herself be won over so easily.
Your brother is nice, Ayers says.
Very nice, Baker says. I'm extremely jealous that he got to spend so much time with you. When I met you at the reception, I can't explain any way to say it except that I was bowled over, blown away. I looked at you and, well, I'd better not say anything else.
You don't even know me, Ayers says. And I hate to tell you this, but I have a rule about dating tourists. I don't do it.
That's good to know, Baker says.
I'm serious, Ayers says. Guys like you and your brother come here, you're on vacation, on the beach all day, hiking, snorkeling, happy hour, out to dinner, and that's all great. That's what you're supposed to do. But then, you get back on the ferry to St. Thomas where you board the plane home to your real life. And I stay here. She opens her arms wide, aware that the back of her right arm is now touching Baker's chest. He gently reaches around her and pulls her close. She lets him. She wants physical contact, meaningless though it may be. It's really not fair that Mick showed up and then admitted that life with Bridget was never paradise. It's not fair that Rosie is dead because she fell in love with a tourist. Or if not a tourist exactly, then a visitor. And if not a visitor, then... Ayers doesn't quite know how to categorize the invisible man, but she does blame him for stealing her friend. And, just say it, for killing her friend. Her best friend. Baker senses something in her breathing. Maybe, or he reads minds, because he touches her chin and says, "Hey, are you okay?" And the next Ayers knows, she's kissing him. She tells herself to stop. This is irrational, self-destructive behavior. She knows exactly nothing about this guy. But the kissing is electric, just like it was the very first time she kissed Mick. Maybe better. Chemistry, she has learned, is either there or it isn't. And wow, yes, it's there. This guy knows what he's doing. His tongue, she can't get enough of it. His arms are so strong. His hands, every cell of her body is suddenly yearning for more. She's going to sleep with him, maybe right here on the beach. No, that would be bad. What if someone sees? It'll be all over town by tomorrow. But she doesn't want to break the spell to go to her truck and drive to her house. It's too far. She wants this now. Does he want it now? He's being shy with his hands. One is on the back of her head, one on the side of her neck. She wants him to put his hand up her shirt. She guides his hand. He just barely fingers her nipple. She groans. She reaches over into his lap. He's hard as a rock, practically busting through his shorts. Oh yes, she thinks, this is happening right now. He pulls away, out of breath. We have to stop. We can't stop, she says.
She strokes his erection through his shorts, and he makes a choking sound, then says,
"You're killing me. But I like you. I like you so much, Ayers. And I don't want it to be like this, here on the beach, over quickly, and then I go home, and you go home, and I'm just the tourist you let through the net because you're sad about your friend, and because I told your ex-boyfriend off."
She draws back. She only had one sip of Schramsberg after service, but she feels lightheaded. Not drunk exactly, but addled, mixed up, off kilter, and yet she knows he's right. She's startled, in fact, at just how right he is.
"You knew that was my ex-boyfriend?"
"You pointed him out at the reception," Baker says. "He was with that unwashed trollop."
"Yes," Ayers whispers. "Bridget.
Let's spend the day together tomorrow," he says. "Can we?"
"We can," Ayers says. "I have the whole day off tomorrow. Day and night."
He squeezes her. "Beach during the day?"
"Wait," she says.
She's supposed to take Maya tomorrow after school and overnight. It's the first time since Rosie died. Ayers can't cancel. She won't cancel.
"Actually, I'm only free tomorrow until 3.
He stiffens.
"Hot date?"
"Something like that," Ayers says.
She doesn't elaborate. She wants him to be jealous.
"But we can still do beach. I'll meet you around 10. We'll get sandwiches. I know a place out in Coral Bay that's always deserted. I swim naked."
"Yes," Baker says. "I'm in."
He stands up, offers her a hand, pulls her in close, and kisses the tip of her nose.
"I don't want you to think I meant anything by stopping. I just want this to be memorable. I want it to be perfect. You deserve that."
He's saying all the right things, but he's a tourist. A tourist. He lives in... She tries to remember. He has a child somewhere and a wife who left him.
"How much longer do you have here?" Ayers asks. "When are you leaving?"
Baker pauses.
"I'm not sure."
"You're not sure?" Ayers says.
She suddenly gets the feeling he's hiding something, and she realizes that she felt that way while talking to Cash as well, as if not everything added up. They're here for a family reunion. The father is dead, but the mother has a date tonight. They don't know the address of where they're staying, and Baker seemed pretty dead set against Ayers driving him home that morning. He was lost, he said.
"Well, you rented a villa, right? How long is the rental?"
"It's not a rental," Baker says. "The villa belongs to my father."
He and Ayers have made their way back up to the road. At the beach bar, a band is playing a Sublime cover.
"But isn't your father dead?"
Ayers asks. Baker stops in the street.
"Did Cash tell you that?"
"Yes," Ayers says. "He said your mother has a date tonight, and I asked if your parents were divorced, and he said no, your father was dead."
"Did he say anything else?"
"Anything else like what?" Ayers says.
It's now more than a feeling, it's a certainty. Something is going on with these two guys that they're not telling her.
"Well, first of all, my mother does not have a date," Baker says.
He takes Ayers' hand and they head back in the direction of La Tapa.
"But we do, tomorrow at 10, right?"
Ayers takes a deep breath of the sweet evening air. The problem, she realizes, is Mick. Mick has made her distrustful. He cheated on her with Bridget, and now Ayers is destined to think everyone is hiding something.
"Right," she says.
Cash. At 11:05, Cash finishes his beer, leaves a tip for Skip, and stumbles out to the front of the restaurant. He has called Baker 3 times but gotten no answer, which is really making Cash's blood boil, because while Baker is out putting the moves on Ayers, the first woman Cash has been attracted to in years, Cash has no way to get home. What is he supposed to do? He has $26 left to his name. All the rest of the cash from his now defunct stores is gone. To live another day, he's going to have to ask his mother or brother for money. He can maybe pass off his flat broke state as a logistical situation, claiming his bank card doesn't work down here, but there are enough cover-ups and lies in this family as it is. He needs to come clean. The stores are gone. It seems like a minor problem. He tried to be someone he wasn't, he failed, and now he will go back to being the person he is, a ski instructor. For some reason, the idea doesn't hold as much appeal as it did before all this happened. He tries Baker again, voicemail. He feels himself about to snap, but then he hears his brother's voice and sees Baker waving an arm. Back in five, Baker says. He's with Ayers. They're holding hands. They walk down the street to a green pickup, and then Cash is treated to the sight of them kissing, really kissing. Cash feels sick. He's married, Cash calls out. But they don't hear him. On the way home, Baker is giddy. He sounds like a teenage girl. He kissed Ayers on the beach. He could have done more, way more, but he stopped her. He stopped her. She was totally into it, eager, ready. But with a woman like Ayers, a quick hookup on the beach isn't good enough. She deserves a bed. A suite at Keneal Bay. He's going to look into it. Look into a suite at Keneal? Cash says. The words leave his mouth just as they happen to drive past the grand landscaped entrance of the Keneal Bay Resort. None of the resort is visible beyond the gatehouse, but Cash imagines it's pretty opulent. Like his father's house, only sexier. You're married! I told you. Anna and I separated, Baker says. She came home on New Year's Day, I kid you not, like 5 minutes before Mom called with the news, and said she was leaving me. She said she was in love with someone else. Really? Cash says. He has never thought of Dr. Anna Schaefer as someone who would be in love with anyone, Baker included. She had appeared decidedly unenthusiastic at the wedding, but Cash understood that Anna was so enthralled with her work that people took a distant second. Irene had long intoned her concern that Anna didn't even have warm feelings for Floyd, her own child. Who is she in love with? Dr. Louisa Ramirez, Baker says, another cardiothoracic surgeon, friend and colleague. Louise? Cash says. He's confused. Or Louisa? Louisa, Baker says. Woman. Really? Cash says. Anna's a lesbian? I guess I can see that. I'm not sure we need to label her, Baker says. It might just be that she has feelings for Louisa in particular. Fair enough, Cash says. At that moment, his phone starts ringing, and he thinks it must be his mother calling to say the coast is clear and they are free to come home. Because who else could it be? When he checks the display, he shakes his head. It says Anna. Wait. He looks at Baker, then back down at his phone. It's almost as if she heard them talking about her. Hello? Cash says. Cash, she says. Hey, it's Anna. Anna Schaefer, Baker's wife. Hi, Cash says. It speaks volumes that she has to explain who she is. Still, he tries to keep his voice neutral. How are you? Do you know where Baker is? She asks. I've been calling him all night, but he won't answer. Cash nearly says, yeah, Baker is right here. But something stops him. Is everything okay? He asks. Everything's fine, Anna says. Would you please let Baker know that Floyd and I are flying down there tomorrow? We land at 1:15 and should be on the 2 o'clock ferry out of Red Hook that will get us to St. John by 3. to St. John tomorrow by 3.
Okay, Cash says.
He can't believe this. Didn't Baker say he had a date with Ayers tomorrow?
You really need to remember to tell him, Anna says. Baker has no idea we're coming. It was basically impossible for me to clear it with work until the very last minute.
Will do, Cash says.
I can count on you? Anna says.
Absolutely, Cash says.
Okay, Anna says, and she sounds happier, maybe even a little excited. See you tomorrow.
Cash hangs up the phone. He can't believe this is happening. He can't believe it.
Who was that? Baker asks. That? Cash says.
No one.
Huck. This is right up there with the craziest things Huck has ever done. A dozen times on the way over, he thought, for the love of Bob, turn around, go home to your book and your beer. Getting mixed up with this woman, the wife, is going to be nothing but trouble. Rosie is dead, and nothing will bring her back. The voice in Huck's head was one of reason, loud and clear, and yet still Huck drove to the North Shore and found the utility pole with the two yellow stripes. Still he ascended the steep, winding road. There were no other homes, only dummy driveways that led to nowhere, until you reached the gate at the top, which had been left open. Huck wondered if this bastard had enough money to buy up the entire hill, just to make certain he had no neighbors. Still, he knocked on the door. Irene looks pretty. It's not a thought he should be having about Russell Steele's widow, but there it is, plain and simple. Huck is a man, built like other men, and so he appreciates Irene's chestnut hair hanging loose and damp down her back, and the black sundress that shows off her arms, her neck, and her pretty feet. She's nervous, he can tell. Her hands are shaking as she accepts the rum, and Huck thinks, better do a shot right away. Why did God provide humans with alcohol if not for situations like this? They make casual chit-chat while Huck prepares the mahi. Irene pours white wine. It's her favorite, from Napa, she says, and Huck makes a sound of general appreciation, as if he cares where the wine is from. Irene has set out cheese and crackers, but she doesn't touch them, and Huck holds back to be polite. Or maybe it's rude not to eat? He can't tell. He should have reviewed his Emily post before coming up here. Huck asks Irene if she has a job. She says yes. She's the editor of something called Heartland Home and Style. It's a glossy magazine, she says, with 175,000 subscribers and a 250,000 in advertising each month.
So it's like Penthouse, then? Huck says.
This gets a laugh out of her, which must come as a surprise because she claps a hand over her mouth.
It's okay, Huck says. You're allowed.
This is the exact wrong response, because Irene's eyes fill with tears, but she takes a breath, recovers, and says, I'm sorry. It's kindness that undoes me.
Understood, Huck says. From here on out, I'll try to be more of a bastard.
Irene smiles. Thank you. Anyway, a day or two before all this, I had something happen at work. They named me executive editor, which is technically a rung up the masthead, but for all intents and purposes, I was fired. They relieved me of all my important duties, my decision-making.
Turned you into an editor emeritus, Huck says.
Irene's eyes grow wide. Exactly.
They're giving you an honorary title, hoping to retire, Huck says.
They couldn't fire me because then advertisers would have made noise, so they got sneaky instead.
You should quit, Huck says. Move down here. I'll hire you as my first mate. You're one hell of a good fisher person.
Irene laughs again, not happily. Not a chance, she says. He gets back in her good graces once he sets down the grilled mahi. He waits until Irene takes a bite.
Wow,
she says. Really? He says. Good? She takes another bite and he the hint. She's not there to plump his ego. He tastes the fish. Yes, perfect. Huck is something of a fanatic about grilling fish. In his opinion, you have a 60-second window with fish. You take it off a minute too early, it's translucent and not quite there. But this is preferable, in his mind, to a minute too late. A minute too late and the fish is dry, overcooked, ruined. Three generations of small women, Leanne, Rosie, and Maya, have been schooled in Huck's feelings about grilled fish, and they all reached a point where they were as persnickety as he was. Huck's fish is always on point because he stands at the grill like the Swiss guard and doesn't let anything distract him. He'd worried that tonight would be an exception because there are a host of distractions here, but praise be, the fish is correct. Irene eats only the fish. The pasta salad and greens remain on her plate. Then she helps herself to seconds. I have no appetite, she says, except for this fish.
Because you caught it yourself, Huck says. Because you pulled it out of blue water.
He catches her eye.
Angler cupcake.
She pours more wine. There at the end of the first bottle, and without hesitating, Irene opens a second. Okay, then, it's going to be that kind of night. Huck has questions, but he won't ask them yet.
Powder room?
He asks, standing up. Irene says, through the living room to the back corner down a short hall. Huck takes his time wandering. The house is grand, but the furnishings are impersonal. He had hoped to see something of Rosie, some indication that she spent time here. There are no photographs, no art, really. It looks like any one of 1,000 rentals. On the other hand, Huck is glad about this for Irene's sake. How unpleasant it would be for her to have to live in the love nest Russell Steele feathered with his mistress. Huck isn't sure when he started taking Irene's feelings into account. Probably when she took the second helping of fish. As Huck washes his hands, he stares at himself in the mirror and asks himself the hardest question. Did Rosie know the invisible man was married? Huck desperately wants to believe the answer is no, but come on. Russell Steele shows up here a week or two per month. The rest of the time he's ostensibly working, but he's never here at Thanksgiving or Christmas. Is he working on Thanksgiving or Christmas? No. He's with his family, his other family, his real family. Rosie was sweet, but she wasn't naive. When Huck gets back to the deck, Irene is standing at the railing with her wine, staring at the water. It's time now, he supposes. He joins her.
Tell me about your children, he says.
She shakes her head. No, she doesn't want to tell him, or she doesn't believe he deserves to hear. But then she says, Baker is 30. He lives in Houston. He's married to a heart surgeon and has a 4-year-old son named Floyd. He's a stay-at-home dad, runs the household, does all the things I used to do when the boys were small. He day trades in tech stocks, too, on the side, but Anna makes most of the money.
Do we like Anna? Huck asks.
Something about the way she said the woman's name makes him curious. Oh, Irene says, she's fine.
That bad? He says.
She's an excellent surgeon. She makes all the Houston best of lists, and her patients love her. But you don't have that kind of demanding career without some personal sacrifice.
The sacrifice in her case?
She's never home. She isn't much of a mother to Floyd. She's a bit dispassionate. It's hard to pierce her armor, to get any kind of human response out of her at all. Now, in her defense, She deals with life and death all day, every day, so telling her about finger painting projects or playground squabbles falls on numb ears.
That's too bad, Huck says. I love hearing the day-to-day details about my granddaughter Maya's life. She and her friend Joni are starting a bath bomb business. They're making them in tropical scents to sell to tourists. I had to order citric acid crystals from Amazon, which will probably take several months to get here. But I treasure all the little stuff, because then they get older and they stop telling you things.
Amen, Irene says.
I didn't mean to hijack the conversation, Huck says. Tell me about your other son.
Cash, she says, short for Cashman. The boys were given the maiden names of my two grandmothers. Cash owns and operates a couple of outdoor supply stores in Denver. Savage Season Outdoor Supply, they're called. Russ gave him the seed money. Russ wanted to see Cash do something with his life, other than being a ski instructor.
Nothing wrong with teaching people to ski, Huck says. Honest living.
If Irene notices the archness in his voice, she doesn't let on. So those are the boys. They're good kids. They don't know what to make of all this. They know about Rosie, although we haven't discussed it. I should tell them I know. It would probably be a weight off their minds. They want to protect me from it, I'm sure. I suppose I'll tell them in the morning.
Always best to be open, Huck says.
Is it? Irene asks. I made them leave the house tonight because you were coming. They don't know I've made contact with you. They don't know about the fishing.
Irene throws back what's left of her wine.
It's like Russ had this giant secret which, in turn, is causing the three of us to keep our own smaller secrets. She looks Huck in the eye for the first time, or the first time without her guard way up. Her eyes are steel blue, the color of a stormy sea. I can't believe this happened to me. And I can't believe I tracked you down, forced you to take me fishing, and then invited you to dinner.
If it makes any difference, Huck says, I'm glad you did.
Are you? She says. He wants to kiss her, but he is too old and out of practice to know if she would welcome this or slap him. Slap him, he thinks. She's been a widow for less than a week.
Yes, he says, I am.
He rips his eyes away from her and focuses on Yost Van Dyke, twinkling in the distance. The view is quite something from up here. Tell me what you know, Irene says. Tell me about Rosie.
All right, Huck says.
Should he go all the way back to the beginning? Huck is new to the island, but not brand new. He has his boat, and he had his best friend, Rupert, out in Coral Bay. Coral Bay is different from town. Folks out there keep to themselves, West Indians and whites alike. Honestly, as soon as you came down the other side of Bordeaux Mountain, it was as though you were on a different island. When Huck wanted to see Rupert, he had to drive to Coral Bay. Rupert simply refused to come west. They would drink at Skinny Legs or Shipwreck Landing, and then, half in the bag, Huck would drive home. Stay left, Rupert used to say, and look out for the donkeys. It was at a full moon barbecue at a place called Miss Lucy's that Rupert introduced Huck to Leanne. There was a three-piece steel band, and she was right in front, dancing in the grass. Love at first sight? Sure, why not? Leanne had a daughter, 15 years old and beautiful, which meant trouble. Rosie's father was long gone, but his people were still around, and while Leanne was working her long hours as a nurse practitioner, Rosie sometimes visited her small aunties and cousins out in Coral Bay, or at least that's what she said she was doing. Part or most of that time, she was, instead, falling in love with a fellow named Oscar from St. Thomas, who was 24 years old and bad news. Oscar worked security for Princess Cruises. Huck suspected he also supplied the staff and passengers with drugs, and as such, he was flush with cash that he liked to show off. He drove a Ducati motorcycle and came over to St. John every chance he got to take Rosie for a ride. Rosie sneaked over to St. Thomas one Saturday in March to attend the Rolex Regatta. She had begged Leanne to be allowed to go, and Leanne said no, she was too young, period. But Rosie had gone anyway, and when Leanne found out, she dispatched Huck to find Rosie and bring her home. Huck and Leanne had been together only a few months at that point, and Huck was still in the thrall of complete infatuation. He would do whatever Leanne asked without question, even though he knew he held no sway or authority over Rosie. He had loaded his truck on the car barge, drove to the St. Thomas Yacht Club, paid $25 to park, and another $5 for a couple of beers to walk around with while he hunted for Leanne's child. Because Huck had been born and raised in the Florida Keys, he was no stranger to regattas. They were about sailing only nominally. Really, they were about drinking. Huck took in the well-heeled crowd holding their cocktails aloft as they danced to the band playing vintage Rolling Stones and the pervasive sense of joy and revelry. Because what better way to spend an afternoon than drinking rum and dancing under the Caribbean sun while a bunch of white guys in $5 million boats negotiated wind and water in the name of an overpriced watch. He was cynical because he was jealous. It looked fun, and he had come to be a buzzkill. Huck found Rosie sitting on Oscar's lap at a picnic table crowded with other West Indians, all of them nattily dressed, all of them wearing Rolexes themselves. They were eating chicken roti and conch stew, drinking caribes. Huck was bigger than Oscar, just barely. But there were some other gentlemen at the table who were bigger than Huck and Oscar combined, with Rosie thrown in. Huck saw no way to tackle his assignment other than head-on. He approached the table. The men and Rosie were all speaking patois. Huck could barely decipher a word, and said, "Rosie, I've come to bring you home." Rosie, he remembered, had blinked lazily, unfazed, and had burrowed like a sand crab into Oscar's arms.
"I'm not going anywhere. I'm staying here."
"No," Huck said, "you're not." "Hey, man," Oscar said, "you heard the lady." "She's not a lady," Huck said. "She's 15 years old." This caught the attention of the other gentlemen at the table. They started lowing and whoaing. Oscar knew how old Rosie was. Maybe he thought she was 16 or 17. However, the others likely thought Rosie was 19 or 20, maybe even older. She was wearing iridescent blue eyeshadow and a halter top the size of a handkerchief. Huck squared his shoulders. "I'm not leaving without her." He hadn't been sure how intimidating he seemed, but he had been to Vietnam before any of these guys were born, and he would remind them of that if he needed to.
"I'm going to have a cigarette while you say your goodbyes."
Oscar had eased Rosie off his lap and then held her face and talked to her gently while she cried. But it was clear Oscar wasn't going to put up a fight, and Huck felt proud of himself, thinking how relieved Leanne would be when both Huck and Rosie pulled in the driveway. As long as he found the girl some other clothes. Huck was ready for Rosie's anger. She climbed into Huck's pickup and slammed the door so hard it nearly fell off. That hadn't surprised him. When they pulled up to Route 322, the sounds of the reggae band still wafting in through Huck's open window, Rosie said,
"I hate you."
That hadn't surprised him either.
"I don't know who you think you are. Maybe you think you're some kind of god because you're white. But no white man tells me what to do."
Huck said,
"There's a popular phrase that goes, don't shoot the messenger. I came at the request of your mother. She had to work, and so she sent me. Frankly, I think you got off easy.
I still hate you, Rosie said.
Huck doesn't think Irene needs or wants to hear all this, so he just says,
I married Leanne when Rosie was a teenager. She was a rebellious child. She dated a West Indian fella, older, from St. Thomas named Oscar. That went on for too long, but it ended when Oscar went to jail.
Lovely, Irene says.
Tell me about it, Huck says. He got drunk and stabbed one of his friends, though not fatally.
Did Rosie go to college? Irene asks.
She did, at UVI in St. Thomas. It's funny, some kids who grow up here can't wait to get away, and some can't bear to leave. Rosie was the latter. She loved it here. She and her mama used to fight like half-starved hens over a handful of feed, but there was a deep emotional attachment. So she stayed. For a long time, she waited tables at Keneal Bay. That's where she met the pirate.
The pirate? Irene says.
It was, let's see, 13 years ago. Valentine's weekend. Some guy, rich, white, showed up on a yacht for the weekend and swept Rosie off her feet.
What was his name? Irene asks.
Never learned it. He came and went. It was just a weekend fling. Rosie called him the pirate, though, because he stole her heart.
So she had a history of this? Irene says.
If by this you mean poor choices in men, then yes, Huck says. I actually suspected the pirate was a made-up story. I thought Rosie was back with Oscar. This would have been after he was released from jail. But when the baby was born, she was very light-skinned. No doubt the father was white.
Irene backs away a fraction of an inch. Baby?
Maya, Huck says. Rosie's daughter, my granddaughter. She's 12.
Oh, Irene says. I didn't realize. She tears up, then starts to soundlessly cry. Huck pulls a handkerchief out of his pocket, which is actually just one of the bandanas he likes to tie around his neck when he's fishing, and hands it to Irene. She shakes it out over the railing like a woman bidding her loved ones goodbye on an ocean liner, then dabs at her eyes.
I'm sorry. I didn't realize Rosie left behind a child.
That's the real tragedy here, Huck says. Me, I'm old. I've known loss. But Maya.
She's 12, you say? And never knew her father? So Rosie was all she had?
Rosie and me, Huck says. Now there's just me. But people will step up. Maya won't get lost. I won't let her get lost. I don't care if I have to keep myself alive until I'm 100 years old.
When did Russ come into the picture? Irene asks.
I couldn't be sure.
But if you had to guess, Irene says, the deed says he bought this house 3 years ago. Had their relationship been going on for 3 years? This is where things get thorny, Huck thinks. Here is where he profoundly regrets his decision to let this woman ever set foot on his boat. They have been acting like they're on the same side. In some sense, they are. They're the bereaved, the survivors. But Huck is Rosie's family, and Irene is Russ's family. Irene wants this whole mess to be Rosie's fault, and Huck wants it to be Russ's fault. Irene is making it sound like 3 years would be nearly inconceivable, but Huck knows that their relationship went on longer than 3 years. Rosie met the invisible man right after Leanne died, 5 years ago.
I'm really not sure, Irene, Huck says. What I know about their relationship, I could write on my thumbnail and still have room for the U.S. Constitution. Rosie told me next to nothing. And like I said, I never had the pleasure of meeting
my husband,
Mr. Steele.
Huck clears his throat.
Your husband.
Irene steps back to the table, fills her glass with more wine, and regards Huck over the rim. as if trying to gauge whether or not he's telling the truth. He is. He knows it sounds unusual. It was unusual. And part of what's at work in Huck is guilt. He should have nipped the relationship, or at least the secrecy about it, in the bud. But like he said, Rosie had met the guy right after Leanne died, and Huck had been in bad shape. Leanne had been sick, sure, her death hadn't come as a total shock, and yet, Huck had been left feeling like his entire right side had been amputated. He'd been glad that Rosie had found someone to distract her from her grief. By the time he realized how pathological the relationship was, it was too late. Rosie was in love, all the way.
"I should have done more," he says. "I should have tried to stop it. I should have hired a private investigator."
Irene sets her wine glass gently down and lets her hands drop to her sides. "You showed up here," she says. "That's more than a lot of men would do." "True," he thinks, but he says nothing. Irene reaches out and takes his hand. "Will you come upstairs with me?" He's speechless. "There's something I need your help with," she says. Huck follows Irene up the stairs, his mind racing. Is she making advances? Is the something that she wants help with getting out of that black dress? This is all moving a little fast for Huck, but he won't say no. She's a grieving widow and he has lost his daughter. Now that he has allowed himself to travel back in time, he realizes that Rosie became his daughter the second he yanked her out of the regatta. Or maybe it was when he paid $20 for a regatta t-shirt to put on over the hanky she was wearing. Or maybe it was when she told him she hated him. Irene needs physical contact, and Huck needs it too, doesn't he? And she's a good-looking woman. They walk down a long white hallway with a vaulted ceiling ribbed with exposed beams. There are rooms off to both sides, bedrooms. Huck peers into each one. They're similar. It feels like a fancy hotel. At the very end of the hall is a closed door. Irene turns the knob. Locked. "When we got here on Thursday, the house had been cleaned out," Irene says. "Every personal item removed. Russ's clothes, gone. All the papers from his office, gone. Someone came and took it all away. Probably his business partner, Todd Croft. Ever heard that name?" Huck shakes his head.
"No."
"This door is locked, and I was hoping you could force it open for me."
"Okay," Huck says.
The door is solid wood. The handle is heavy. Nothing about this house is cheap.
"Have you asked your sons?"
"I didn't ask them," Irene says. "And they obviously haven't been blessed with any natural curiosity because neither of them has noticed. I'm afraid of what we're going to find inside." Huck presses against the door. He's a big guy, but breaking down this door is beyond him. He'll have to pick the lock. The nice thing about owning a boat for 40 years is that he can tinker with the best of them. He is a world champion tinkerer.
"Do you have a hairpin?" he asks. "Or bobby pin?"
"I do," Irene says. "Hold on." She's back in a few seconds with an ancient, sturdy steel bobby pin that looks like it came straight from the head of Eleanor Roosevelt. It takes Huck a few moments of poking and twisting. He doesn't have his reading glasses and the wine has gone to his head somewhat, but then, click, he gets it. Lock popped. He hesitates before turning the knob because he's also afraid of what they're going to find inside. More dead bodies? Assault rifles and refrigerators full of money? Who was this guy, Russell Steele, and what was he into? Irene clearly doesn't have the first idea. Huck opens the door, and the first words that come to him are those of Jerry Garcia, "Sunshine Daydream." It's a bedroom with a huge white canopy bed decorated with turquoise and purple pillows. The wallpaper is a swirl of purple, green, and turquoise tie-dye. There's a white powder puff beanbag chair, a desk, and a dressing table. Maya would love this room, Huck thinks. Then he sees the letters painted on the length of one wall. M-A-I-A.
Oh, he says, this is Maya's room.
Irene slips past Huck into the room and starts poking around. Hairbrush and pick on the dressing table, a bottle of shea butter lotion, a book on the nightstand entitled The Hate You Give. Huck thinks to speak up on behalf of Maya's privacy. She's only 12, but she still deserves respect. Huck understands why the door was locked. It would have been impossible to undo this room on short notice. How must Irene feel, knowing her husband decorated a room like this for his lover's daughter? Is it salt on the wound? Huck supposes so, although he, for one, is happy to see that Maya had a safe space of her own in this house. He will be Maya's champion to the end.
There can't be anything too important in here, he says. She hasn't mentioned it.
Irene spins around. Do you have a picture of her?
Of Maya? Yes, of course.
Huck takes his phone out of his pocket. There she is, a close-up of her face, his screensaver. Irene takes the phone from Huck and studies the photograph. He expects her to comment on how pretty Maya is, exquisite, really, and elegant in a way that belies her years. But when Irene looks up, her steel-blue eyes are spooked, like she has seen a ghost. No, Huck thinks. Please, no.